Our next case is 2024-60231, Airlines for America et al. Versus the United States Department of Transportation. You may proceed, Mr. Kaborski.
Thank you, Judge. I'll be pleased to report. Shai Boretsky for Airlines for America and the other petitioners in 24-60231. As the state panel recognized, DOT exceeds its authority by prescribing a code of conduct for airlines. Under Section 41712, DOT can investigate the particular carrier's practice. If it finds the practice to be unfair or deceptive, it can order the carrier to stop practice. But it can't make generalized rules for the industry that dictate what practices carriers must adopt. Just read Section 41712's plain text and compare it with the Civil Aeronautics Board's authority, which Congress revoked in deregulating the airline industry. The CAB had authority to, quote, prescribe the lawful practice after finding an unlawful one. DOT doesn't. That is the, quote, best reading of Section 41712. That's what DOT itself said in a notice of proposed rulemaking in October 2025. DOT said it has only the, quote, adjudicatory authority to issue case-by-case orders to stop a particular practice after notice and an opportunity for a hearing. The rule here exceeds that authority. Rather than adjudicate a particular carrier's practice, DOT issued the rule after deciding if the industry should do things differently to implement DOT's preferred view of comparison price shopping, based on disputed testimony from consumer advocates about reporting consumer confusion. DOT didn't order any airline to stop any particular unfair or deceptive practice, which is all DOT had the authority to do. Nor did it issue a rule, say, providing guidance about how it would interpret the term unfair or deceptive in adjudicating airline practices. Instead, DOT imposed on airlines a series of detailed website design specifications reflecting the department's view of good policy. That was unlawful. DOT can't explain why its brief now and the October 2025 NPRM say two different things. But the correct reading of the statute is straightforward. The court should vacate the rule in its entirety. DOT suggests only partial vacature, based on an admitted notice and comment violation. But it makes no sense to dodge the statutory authority question, particularly when a state panel has already gotten it right, and DOT speaks out of both sides of its mouth and could reimpose its code of conduct. I welcome the court's questions.
Did you file a 28J letter with this notice of proposed rulemaking?
We did, Judge Jones.
Well, there was one about the standards for conducting hearings. That's not what you're talking about, though, is it?
So the one that I'm talking about is the October 2025 NPRM. The citation for it is 90 Federal Register at 48850. And it describes what DOT's authority is under 41712. And the way it describes it, DOT said the department's authority to issue regulations under Section 41712 is limited to declaring the practice to be unfair or deceptive after notice and an opportunity for a hearing. The department's rulemaking authority under Section 41712 does not extend beyond that application.
I'll take your word for that. I noticed in the DOT brief they said the department has announced plans to initiate a rulemaking in early 26 that would examine rescinding the ancillary fee disclosure and other miscellaneous requirements. Is that correct?
My understanding that is limited to what they've said in their
So here they're saying they want to uphold the authority to make this broad rule, but they're also saying we're proposing to rescind it.
That seems to be what they're saying, at the same time that they are making inconsistent statements between the NPRM, which talks about the limited authority under the statute to to adjudicate particular practices to be unfair or deceptive on the one hand, and on the other hand, the argument that they've made in their brief defending a rule that goes far beyond that authority and actually prescribes, again, as the state panel put it, a code of conduct for airlines. This,
but your position, counsel, your position is that they do have general rulemaking authority, plus they have specific authority to adjudicate unfair, deceptive practices. Those two positives don't add up to sufficient support to rulemake against unfair, deceptive practices?
Well, whatever rulemaking authority they have is rulemaking authority to carry out 41712. And 41712, by its terms, talks about identifying and adjudicating a particular practice and declaring that particular practice to be unlawful. So the court doesn't need to go so far as to hold that DOT has no rulemaking authority at all. DOT could, for example, issue a rule that defines what unfair deceptive means.
No, but your position is they don't have authority to pass price-related rules. In other words, that DOT accepts that it can't set the prices, but it's still saying what I think the D.C. Circuit said in spirit, which I didn't see cited or discussed by you, which is that they do have authority to pass price-related rules. So I guess the question is, would we have to split with the D.C. Circuit, and would its regulations that it upheld under rulemaking authority now be essentially vacated by us?
No, first, you would not have to split with the D.C. Circuit. D.C. Circuit obviously was addressing a different rule, but critically, in the D.C. Circuit case, the statutory authority argument that we are making now was not raised by the petitioners there. So the D.C. Circuit simply didn't consider that the statutory authority question under 41712. With respect to Judge Higginson, your other question about, well, whether DOT can do anything with respect to prices, we're of course talking here about disclosure of ancillary fees. We're not saying that DOT can't adjudicate the fairness or unfairness of an airline's particular practice with respect to how it discloses ancillary fees. What DOT can't do is promulgate a rule that requires airlines to do that in one particular way.
Would you please explain a bit, because I don't see it in your briefs here, it's elsewhere, why this is a 186-page rule, and exactly what is the detail of what it requires airlines to have, as I understand it, on the very first screen that pops up about affairs?
So this rule contains a number of different prescriptive requirements of airlines. I'll get to the first screen point, but one point I want to emphasize first. The rule requires airlines to adopt a verbatim disclosure on its website about seat selection. Airlines must use the exact script that DOT, has written. Mandating that exact script is not stopping an airline from engaging in a particular unfair practice. It is implementing DOT's view of how airlines should communicate with their customers. That is not what Section 41712 authorizes DOT to do. That is at odds with the deregulatory purpose of the ADA. Under the Civil Aeronautics Board's authority, which preceded DOT, it did have the authority to prescribe a particular practice when it found an unlawful one. But DOT simply doesn't have that authority here. In terms of other things that the rule does, it requires airlines as well as ticket agents to disclose, quote, during the itinerary search process at the first point where a fare and schedule is provided in connection with a specific flight itinerary. You have to, at that point, post baggage check fees for the first bag, baggage check fees for the second bag. These disclosures have to appear, again, on that first page. They can't be by hyperlink. DOT has imposed those requirements. That's not stopping a practice. That's telling airlines, this is the one way you must.
And they also have to account for the status of the passenger, right?
They have to display passenger-specific information accounting for status. That's right. So the disclosures have to be passenger-specific.
So that means that depends on whether you're a member of a particular frequent flyer club, whether you have a bank card that gives you frequent flyer miles, and of course we know there are numbers of those. So they have to account and adjust for those on a rolling basis, correct?
That all has to be displayed again on the first page. This is all a far cry from what Section 41712 envisions, which is that DOT will identify a particular practice that a particular airline is engaged in and adjudicate that practice.
I'm sorry, were you not finished, Judge?
No, go ahead.
Let me ask you, your responses and Judge Jones's question really go in, it seems to me, to perhaps over breadth of this regulation, I want to ask you a narrower question of why the authority doesn't exist. You're probably more familiar than I am with American Hospital Association versus NLRB, which says that the statute gives specific adjudicatory authority to an agency. That agency can also adopt, even based just on that authority, rules, regulations of general applicability that will help guide those decisions. Why aren't we in that area insofar as the authority is concerned? And the argument, justified or otherwise, really is that this rule is perhaps arbitrary and capricious, it's overdone, all of which is, I don't think, force at this point.
Judge Southwick, I think there are two questions with respect to authority, and American Hospital Association only gets at the first one. First question is, can the agency promulgate any sort of rule at all pursuant to Section 41712? Second question is, if it can, what is the scope of the agency's authority to promulgate the rule pursuant to Section 41712?
And you can answer one of those questions?
I'd like to answer both. We are not suggesting that you need to go so far as to hold that DOT cannot promulgate any rule with respect to 41712.
And specifically meaning the sorts of fees and other things that are in this rule.
The limitation is that the rule under Section 41712 cannot mandate that airlines engage in particular conduct. What it can do is, again, for example, it can define what unfair deceptive means. This is the standard for how we're going to interpret that.
Well, what if that definition was it's unfair and whatever not to disclose all relevant fees when the first price appears, which is basically, I think, what this much more detailed rule is requiring?
The only way that DOT would have the authority to get to that point is if it ruled out all other alternatives as being unfair or deceptive. What about, for example, as was presented to DOT, the option of letting consumers who want baggage check fee information, which not every consumer does, let them check a box on that first screen. And if they check the box that they want it, they'll get the information. If not, they'll avoid the card. That's a solution that's totally fair, in our view, that was offered to DOT that DOT didn't consider. The DOT has ruled that out by mandating its alternative approach for how fees have to be displayed.
In other words,
that mandate goes beyond adjudicating and stopping a particular practice. It is dictating DOT's preferred practice without ruling out alternatives. So it's not that DOT can never promulgate a rule providing any guidance. That's what American Hospital Association speaks to.
You seem to be saying that the only rule is that they can prohibit certain things as not being fair, but they cannot create a specific set of things that they have identified are the fairest or the most fair or something like that. There's some certainly line drawing that we're in the business of doing, but I'm not sure where we were getting the reasoning for that line.
So first, what they have done here is identified the only, in their view, fair way of doing things. That's what the mandate is.
Then that means that if an airline used an equally fair and non-deceptive method of disclosure, they would have committed a violation.
Correct. And as for where the limitation comes from, why it is that DOT can't do that, it comes straight from the text of 41712, which is, again, the airline can adjudicate a particular practice to be unfair, and it can stop that practice.
So you read 41712 to actually reduce and limit the powers, the general rulemaking powers of 40113.
That's not how I would read it. I would read the general rulemaking authority to be the authority to carry out the particular provisions of the statute And so it's just the authority to carry out 41712, not to expand.
But we know Congress wrote explicitly in this, in the penalty provision, that 41712 contemplates that rules will be promulgated pursuant to that specific statute.
The penalty provision has an A and a B. The A recites a laundry list of statutory provisions that can be violated. The B, as the state panel explained, recites a laundry list of regulations that might be promulgated pursuant to those statutory provisions. But B is not saying that any provision in A permits prescriptive rulemaking of the sort that's issued.
So is your position basically that under 41712, the agency may make rules to set the stage for the adjudications that that section envisions? In other words, they can define various aspects of it, but they can't prescribe things. Is that your position?
I think it can do that. And if you look at pages 43 and 47 of our amendment brief, we cite there rules that DOT has promulgated that define what is unfair and deceptive. So DOT can do that.
Okay, I do have to wonder why, given that the ruling of the panel was sending it back to have them discuss with you, and we were in the meantime staying the rule, I don't understand why y'all didn't find that helpful. Because in talking with them, maybe y'all can figure out something that the airlines can do that's not overly expensive or overly difficult, but that makes sure that the people checking in are able to do it and learn what they need to learn and not go, oh my gosh, I have all these costs and so on. Why can't y'all just go do that? I don't understand why you took it to en banc when that was what we did.
Well, respectfully, Judge Haynes, there was an extensive back and forth notice and comment process before this rule was promulgated. As the panel correctly recognized, the notice and comment procedures, even so, were not followed. But there was an extensive process, and DOT came out with a rule that exceeds its statutory authority. Going back to DOT without providing DOT with the guardrails on its statutory authority leaves DOT able to simply reinstitute another rule that provides for prescriptive rules that go beyond its statutory authority. I'm just going to go back to Judge Wilson's question and finish on what it is that DOT could do. One example, Judge Wilson, as we were discussing, is DOT can promulgate a rule that sets a standard about what unfair or deceptive means. DOT, in its brief, cites a number of other rules that it says, under our view, would be impermissible. Some would be permissible, some would not. But to give you an example of rules, it might be okay. Certain disclosure rules, like, for example, if you book a flight that is marketed as a nonstop flight that actually requires changing aircraft, DOT can say that's an unfair or deceptive practice. Stop doing that.
What about mandating disclosure of on-time performance so you don't buy a ticket that you can't make the connecting flight to?
So I think in theory, DOT, I can't speak to that particular rule, which may have aspects that are impermissible, but in theory, DOT could find that it is an unlawful or unfair practice to misrepresent the timeliness of a flight and tell airlines, stop advertising flights that are chronically delayed.
What about a rule that says if you purchase a ticket, you've got 24 hours to get a refund?
I don't think DOT can do that. I think that is mandating. That's not just saying, here's an unfair practice. That's saying, here's the only practice that is going to be permissible is providing a 24-hour refund. There may be circumstances. Imagine that an airline wanted to offer a deeply discounted ticket. You can fly from here to D.C. for $10, but no refunds. Like you buy it, it's yours. Is that unfair? DOT has adjudicated whether it's unfair. That might be very consumer beneficial.
But I guess the last, I mean, I appreciate you going over, but why isn't it the right way that we look at this 712 authority to prosecute and adjudicate specific deceptions? Then when you get enough evidence of industry-wide abuse, you then use your general rulemaking to say, now we're going to come up with a rule subject to notice and comment, subject to arbitrary and capricious judicial review. And if that, then you've got a rule, industry. All of you have been doing this too much.
I think in that situation, there is something that DOT can do, but it doesn't go quite as far as what your question is positing. DOT could promulgate a rule that says, we have seen and adjudicated the following practices by airlines. Here are the principles that we have drawn from those adjudications about what makes something unfair or deceptive. Airlines, you know, go forth. What DOT cannot do, though, is say, and because we have seen this practice five times, we are going to foreclose all potential innovation in this deregulated industry. We're not going to let airlines try anything else. The only thing they can do is follow our vision of what is
but
the
it's
only
disclosure. It's just disclose what you're doing. It's not here's the price, here's the rule. It's tell the consumer that if they've got an extra bag, it's going to be $50. Or if they want a seat next to the exit, it's going to be another. It's just disclosure so American consumers in a deregulated environment get to know what the cost will be.
I think there's a difference between whether we're talking about just the fact of disclosure, which, by the way, all airlines in this case, all the airlines that I represent in this case, do disclose their ancillary fees to consumers. DOT hasn't disputed that. There's a difference between mandating disclosure and mandating the when, the where, the how, the verbatim language. That goes beyond just the fact of disclosure, and that's what DOT has done here.
Okay. I think and one of my colleagues...
I just have one question. The panel, everybody apparently now agrees that at the very least, the agency acted arbitrarily and capriciously by trying to shore up its lack of findings of necessity with that RUP analysis, right? What that implies to me that DOT never really adjudicated anything that was going on that was unfair or deceptive.
I think that's right.
The fact that they admitted it. So if the thing goes back, even under arbitrary and capricious, they'll have to prove in some way, and which they have not chosen to do so far, that in fact consumers were being tendency to be misled.
And if I may, 2 points to respond to that. One, I agree, they were not adjudicating a particular airline practice here. What happened here is this was a process that DOT initiated based on complaints from consumer organizations, and based on that, they came up with their preferred vision that they imposed. This is not a situation where they said, airlines A, B, and C are doing the following. Let's look at that and give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to each of them. Second, although DOT has admitted the procedural violation here, it makes no sense to skip over the authority question and only adjudicate the procedural violation.
Chief.
Thank you. Oh, we've got a question.
I do. So it sounds to me like you're saying the DOT can only prohibit, but it cannot prescribe. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. It's a prohibitory.
And so they could examine six different ways to do something. And they'd have to issue a rule that says, we prohibit these five. But they couldn't just do a rule that says we prescribe this one. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. They might be able to reach a point.
And that makes sense to you.
I think it makes perfect sense in light of Section 417.2, which talks about stopping a particular air carrier's particular...
Well, 46301, that's a lot. The 46301A5D actually uses the word prescribe, referencing what you can do under 417.2. It says a regulation prescribed or ordered issued under 417.2. Uses the word prescribe. So it could prescribe.
It's talking about prescribing a regulation. It's not talking about a prescriptive regulation. There's a difference. Prescribe in that context is talking about the synonym for promulgate. Yes, DOT can promulgate some regulation under 417.2, but going back to my earlier...
So they can prescribe, but it better not be prescriptive.
They can promulgate a regulation. That's what prescribe means in that context. But it cannot be a regulation that mandates a particular practice. That is the whole point of deregulation in this industry. DOT can say, this practice is no good, but airlines then can innovate with different approaches and try to come up with options that benefit consumers. And DOT retains the authority under 417.2 to examine those practices and say thumbs up or thumbs down, but not the authority to tell airlines this is the one and only way that you must do things. That was the authority that DOT's predecessor had. Congress took that away.
Thank you, Mr. Dvoretsky.
Thank you.
We have time for rebuttal. We'll hear from Mr. Crowell. Crowell.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the court. Donald Cole for Spirit Airlines and Frontier Airlines. Since the dawn of air travel, air advertisements have always included a price and a destination. Fly to Dallas, New Orleans for $29. Simple, truthful, and effective. The rule before the court today seeks to upend that, and it's based on a premise that because 665 passengers from 2019 to 2021 complained in some way about bag or ancillary fees out of the 2 billion that flew during those same years, that action is warranted. The issue is that in 1978, Congress made a fundamental choice about American air travel. It fired the central planner, the Civil Aeronautics Board, and it hired the referee, the Department of Transportation. It explicitly withdrew the government's power to manage domestic pricing and fare displays. Instead of the federal control regime, we now have a regime of market competition. And the difference between those two is the hybrid case. The planner draws up the playbook. The referee calls balls and strikes. We ask this court to vacate the rule for three independent reasons. First, on statutory authority. A plain reading of the text is clear. Congress decided that DOT shall no longer have the authority to manage how prices are presented to the public proactively, and it delegated it cabinet authority for foreign air travel only to do that. That's in Chapter 415, Section 41504. Reading 41712 in a way that allows the DOT to act this rule here would make Chapter 415 surplusage. Second, the First Amendment. The rule forces a double-barreled speech regulation. It restricts truthful, fair-only advertising, and it compels a government-scripted menu of services that the consumer has not asked for. Because it also discriminates on speaker basis, Sorrell requires that heightened scrutiny apply. And third, on the APA, the rule is arbitrary and capricious because it ignores the unique low-cost carrier business model, the severe operational risk that the costs and burdens of this technology require from low-cost carriers. And lastly, on remedy, and I want to address the question that came up a few times about should we remand? Absolutely not. Remanding would set a dangerous precedent that any agency, not just DOT here, can smuggle in an analysis and a final rule and avoid substantive review. And that would be, you'd be rubber stamping that if you said the DOT could do that here, because really the issue is not that we didn't have a chance to comment on the RUF study. The issue is the statutory authority that DOT does not have to issue the rule in the first place.
Are you welcoming questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the notes and comment, did you specifically say statutory overreach, no authority?
Yes, the Frontier filed comments, the January comments filed by Frontier do raise the issue of DOT not having statutory
Okay, the two, I didn't see you reference at all in your brief 40113, and yet that's the statutory grant to issue prescriptive regulations.
Yes, so we don't challenge the overall authority of DOT to issue rules under 41712. It's done so in the past, and those rules have been in two particular buckets. One, which is a performance failure, and that gets to the types of rules on denied boarding, materially unrealistic scheduling, which was brought up. You know, if an airline advertises that the flight leaves at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, and 50% of the time it doesn't, you know, that's where DOT has stepped in on unrealistic and deceptive scheduling. Tarmac delays are another one, and all these go to the fact that the customer doesn't get what they paid for. We don't challenge that DOT can issue rules on that in that bucket. The other one is the customer's not getting the product at the price advertised. So, you know, if you see a $100 fare and you get to the checkout, you don't add bags, you don't add anything else, but then there's another $50 fee, that's a deceptive practice we can use, you can regulate. We don't challenge that.
So what relief do you seek? You seek vacature of the rule. What relief specifically would you go away happy with?
Well, there's numerous grounds, Your Honor. We think that the cleanest one here is on statutory authority. We think the way that DOT has issued this rule to control price, the first interaction a customer has with an airline just contradicts not only the deregulation era, but almost 100 years of air travel where even the Civil Aeronautics Board never regulated this.
But if we were to vacate under the APA,
That would be okay as well. We think there are reasons to do that. We think that arbitrary and capricious.
I'm not foreshadowing. I'm just trying to figure out what you're arguing for.
Yes, Your Honor. We do think that the procedural grounds would probably not be appropriate for a few reasons. The one I mentioned about the precedent smuggling and, you know, information at the end and avoiding the substantive review. The other is the practical impact of that is DOT then has to go withdraw the rule, which was brought up. They issued a notice of withdrawal in, I think it's March 2026. That has to go through notice and comment. And then they have to issue another withdrawal action after that that can also be challenged, come back into court. And then you have a zombie rule floating around for who knows how long on the same reason. So it makes sense to give certainty to the industry and decide that issue now rather than leave the zombie rule in place.
So to ask Chief Judge Elrod's question in a slightly different way, I think that's what I'm doing. If we were to agree with you, what would the final paragraph of our order say in terms of what we're directing to happen procedurally in this matter?
I think they would say that the rule is vacated. If you're doing it on the APA grounds, that the agency acted arbitrarily and capriciously. They didn't consider under State Farm, they didn't consider the policy factors that Congress put in place. They didn't consider the hundreds of millions of dollars of impact immediately on the carriers to implement this complex system. They didn't consider the fact that Congress said you need to be hands-off, you need to pump balls and strikes, not make the plays for the airlines.
So it's vacated and that's the end of the proceeding. I'm just asking you what directive we would give in summary of an otherwise maybe a long opinion.
We would ask for, yeah, the rule's vacated. If DOT wants to come up with a new rule that, you know, addresses an actual problem, they can do that. And then you actually would almost be doing the government a favor by vacating versus remand, because then they don't have to go through the whole notice and comment and challenging years of potential litigation on the other side.
Well, what's your position on this idea about vacating and maintaining the stay that the state panel issued?
Well,
remanding and maintaining a stay.
Remanding. So we would.
Is there any authority for that?
No, and that would be my third point on remedies. This court's the ordinary practice of this circuit is to vacate when the rule is unlawful. There are certain situations where, you know, if there's reliance or the rule's already been in place, things that don't apply here, you could remand to avoid disruption, but there's no evidence the government doesn't show any that those factors apply. And so we just asked this court to follow its precedent on an aviation statute order.
Before we get to remedy, could you speak briefly to the Seventh Circuit opinion in United Airlines as to whether the predecessor provision actually gave DOT, the predecessor authority, to be able to pass general rulemaking having perceived specific instances of deception?
Yeah, we don't see as United cases conflicting with our position. I think, as I mentioned, there's certain areas where they have regulated. As long as it's within those two buckets, it doesn't cross over into price control.
Where's the statutory authority for the buckets?
Well, I think that to just reframe your question, you always have to start with an agency. Where is the authority to begin with? And we know DOT previously had authority to control prices, control how those prices were presented to the public, and to ensure that the carriers adhere to those practices, those published rates. The Congress took that authority away for domestic travel. And if you look at 41504, it has the authority right there. DOT has the authority to make requirements on how the airlines present their tariffs, their fares, and their charges.
But only in the international context.
Only when flights that
so Congress took it away domestically while preserving it internationally, which strongly implies the negative that Congress did not preserve it domestically.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly correct. And you don't even have to infer. You just look at what authority do they have. It's right there. You know, Congress intended DOT to have this authority to do the exact same thing they're doing, trying to do through this rule, but it's in a different context.
What is that? What is it? You talked about price. What is it else that they took away, other than what is it that you're talking about? I missed.
So when we think about the rate filing doctrine, there's two components, the price and the publication of it. And so Congress took away both of those. There used to be another section, section 403 of the Civil Aeronautics Act, which allowed, let DOT the authority to control that, control where the carriers flew, control how much they charged, what they were required to tell the public about it, all the details about flying. Congress took that away for domestic travel.
Well, Counsel, what 41504 says, probably quoted, but I'll quote it for you, in the way prescribed by Secretary of Transportation regulation, every air carrier and foreign air carrier shall file with the Secretary, publish and keep open. Then he gets into foreign travel. Isn't the rate filing, and this is certainly not my area, isn't the rate filing just talking about that and not talking about what would appear on a screen to the consumer?
Well, Your Honor, it addresses that. I understand the language. What that authority does is it allows the government to say, here's what you need to present.
And well, let me ask you, what was abolished by deregulation? It was the obligation, was it not, by carriers to file with the Secretary the rates they're going to charge, and then they'd have to get approval for that. That's now open, and under this regulation that we're dealing with here, that's not changed. So aren't we talking about something much different than the kind of rate filing that 41504 is talking about?
Not exactly, Your Honor. So there was the actual rate you had to file with the Civil Aeronautics Board, and that was a big book.
Right.
But under the same statute in Section 403, the Civil Aeronautics Board also required the airlines to publish those rates, those charges, those fees, those details anywhere else that CAB decided. It could be at the airport kiosk, it could be at the ticket counter, it could be at a local remote office. So it wasn't just strictly give it to the government. It was, we're going to tell you where exactly you're going to present these fees anywhere.
If we were to resolve this case under the statutory interpretation theory rather than under the APA theory, would we have to address these other grounds like non-delegation and major questions, or could we just, is the case easier under the APA theory than the statutory interpretation, given that you are not taking a complete and total position that you can't promulgate rule, that they can't promulgate rules, because then you have to parse what is allowed and what's in what bucket, as one of our colleagues said.
I think you would have to address the statutory question before we get to the APA.
So we're going to have to address it anyway.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't see an APA decision for you, because you have to assume there's some authority to do.
But it can just be based upon the language and not on whether it's delegated or whether it's a major question.
Correct, yes. We think just look at the statute, it's clear. There's the authority that they're trying to use is not, you know, on its face. 41712.
So you're not trying to import deregulation somehow informs how we read the language. And I ask that because there's been a lot of talk about the impact of deregulation, but it would seem to me the opposite as to where you'd get. In other words, Congress says, okay, companies, you're deregulated. You can high prices, low prices, hide the prices. But therefore, all the more reason, we, the government, have to make sure you just tell the consumer in this deregulated price environment what the prices are. Why doesn't that deregulation make disclosure, just transparency about your add-ons, all the more compelling rather than less compelling?
Well, I think Fred already mentioned, airlines already do give the customer the information. It's before you get to the fare, it's one click, you know, on the next screen after. You cannot get to the end of the checkout process without knowing you are not getting a carry-on bag or a check bag. And Congress left that to market forces.
Mr. Kroll, as your colleague said there, there's no evidence that any airline has not disclosed. It's just a question of how and where, right?
That's correct.
Number one. Number two, how much will it cost the low-cost carriers to comply with this rule? And what's your argument about arbitrary and capricious in regard to that?
Yes, Your Honor. So in your first question, we live in the most transparent time as far as it comes to air travel. And, you know, if you think back to 1978, it was publishing in a newspaper. You had to go, maybe to make a phone call, go to the airport to get ticket prices. Now that information is available in seconds, in clicks. So the airlines do everything they can to make sure the customers know what they're purchasing. Otherwise, they wouldn't come back. And on the second issue of cost, as we noted in our declarations in the emergency stay motion, I mean, we're talking about, just for Spirit and Frontier, over hundreds of millions for just putting the system in, at least $100 million. And as far as potential loss of revenue, because of the way the plumbing works with the third parties they have to get this information to, you could immediately lose over $1 billion of your revenue source. And the DOT didn't consider that at all.
Did the explanation for the rule include anything about that?
It did not, Your Honor.
Seeing no further questions, you've saved time for rebuttal, Mr. Cole.
Thank you.
Mr. Springer.
Thank you, Your Honor. So may it please the court. Brian Springer on behalf of the federal government. As we explain in our brief, the merits panel correctly concluded that the rule challenged in these cases was issued without observance of notice and comment procedures required by the Administrative Procedure Act. To support the rule, the agency relied on a study about the travel habits of college students that was released months after the close of the comment period. Although agencies are not required to redo notice and comment, whenever new information comes to light after the comment period, the problem here was that the data from the study did not corroborate other data in the rulemaking record or confirm prior assessments by the agency. For that reason, you know, the agency should have afforded petitioners and the public an opportunity to comment on the study, and that's a sufficient basis on which to grant the petitions for review. Because petitioners acknowledge their broader arguments, including their arguments about statutory authority, could implicate a whole host of familiar and longstanding consumer protection rules in this space. The court doesn't need to reach any of those questions here because, as I mentioned, the notice and comment error is dispositive. I welcome the court's questions.
Counsel, I didn't see in your brief that you responded to the 41504 argument that this is a rate filing issue and affects your authority. Give me your take on that.
Sure, a couple points on that. I mean, I think our brief did respond to it and said that this case is not about the rate filing doctrine. You know, it's not a situation in which DOT is requiring airlines to file rates with the agency and then only charge those rates. And that is what Congress abolished in the Deregulation Act in 1978. But I just think that that doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about disclosure rules that are designed, or at least, you know, were intended in the department's previous determination to go after an unfair and deceptive practice in the industry, and that is authority that the department, the agency, has had since 1938. That's unchanged authority that Congress has always retained.
Well, don't you agree that a 186-page rule is far longer than any other rule that's been promulgated about unfair or deceptive advertising?
Your Honor, I think that this rule, at least the PF of the rule, is only about 58 pages.
Oh, is that all?
Your Honor, most of the description of the rule is just laying out the previous agency's determination about why these are unfair or deceptive practices. I don't think that this is a situation in which the agency, you know, is spelling out a huge number of requirements. It's building on previous requirements that it's...
You say it doesn't involve rate filings, but at the same time, once you promulgated this very didactic method of revealing what all these charges are on the basis of each customer who's inquiring, if the airline has deviated from that, it is liable for an adjudication that it violated your rule and will have to pay thousands of dollars, correct?
Yeah, there are other rules that say that you can't raise the price after a consumer buys, you know, purchases airfare.
But we're just talking about this rule, and a violation of this rule can incur, I think, the other 43110 $75,000 fine, right?
Janet, there are fines that can come, you know, through violation.
So why doesn't that affect rates?
Your Honor, I mean, I guess I am not seeing the connection. I mean, what the
Well, you don't disclose. You are charging X amount for the second bag. You put it on page 2 of the disclosure. It's hard for me to envision what's going to happen. But you put it on page 2 instead of a pop-up on page 1. Ergo, you have violated the rule. Ergo, the fine is $75,000, which is far higher than the just saying you can't charge that amount. So essentially, you're affecting the rate.
Your Honor, I mean, I don't think that's the right way to think about the rule. I mean, what the rule did, the determination that the department made, was that failing to disclose upfront baggage claim and baggage change and cancellation fees was unfair or deceptive because consumers wouldn't be able to figure out what the actual cost of their trip was going to be. Now, you know, as I mentioned at the outset, you know, there's a notice and comment violation here that doesn't require the court to actually get into the specifics.
Well, the problem with the violation of this minitude is that it simply has to do with the RUP report, which was trying to show up what the rule originally said was, we can't really quantify if anybody's injured by the way in which this information is disclosed. So the RUP report said, well, 46% of students, blah, blah, blah. All right, we remand it. We say vacate and remand. No. Yeah. Stay and remand is what the panel said. And the airlines say the RUP report is full of beans. And the agency can say, no, it's not. We think it's good. Rule reinstated. So 2 or 3 years down the line, we're back here again, right?
Your Honor,
on whether the rule was arbitrary and capricious.
Sure, I mean, a couple of points on that. I mean, I think, first of all, what you're describing is the reason that we have conceded that there was a notice and comment violation that was prejudicial here.
Because you want to go back and decorate the file, have the same rule, because you don't want us to rule on that, and then we'll be back here again, because that will not solve the problem.
Your Honor, I mean, I don't think that's what the record reflects. As we noted in our brief, and I think as you discussed with the other side, the agency has issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, it plans to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking early this year that would rescind all of the challenge requirements in this case because the current administration, you know, might make a different judgment about what requirements are necessary in this year.
Well, wouldn't it have made more sense just to vacate the rule on your own accord, which I believe you could do, and leave us be?
Your Honor, I mean, I'm not sure whether or not the agency has the authority to do that, at least when we're still in litigation. But at this point, the government has conceded that there's an error, and I think that the right remedy here, which is allowed by the specific statutory scheme we're talking about, is to set aside the challenge portions of the rule.
Why aren't we just vacating the whole rule? Why aren't we just vacating the rule, as our case law would do? And was this addressed in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor, this was addressed in our brief.
Where does it say that we cannot vacate under our precedent in this circumstance?
Your Honor, if you let me just 1 second pull up the page.
So why can't you can just tell us why is it that we cannot vacate under our precedent if the rule is deficient in many respects? Why can't we just vacate the rule and be done and go on our way? And then if you were going to do that anyway, so be it. Or else you can promulgate a new rule and that could be litigated some other day.
So, Your Honor, a couple points on that. I mean, I'm pointing to, I think, pages 20 to 21 of the brief and what we say there. And so, I mean, I just want to make abundantly clear that we agree that under the specific statutory scheme we're talking about, the court has the authority to set aside the rule. And so we think it would be fine after finding that there was a notice and comment error here to set aside the rule. Now, the one argument we made was with respect to the challenge requirements, because We read petitioner's briefs as not challenging all of the requirements in the rule, so we thought it was appropriate to limit the relief to that. But of course, if the court thought that everything was intertwined, the court could set aside the whole rule.
I mean, well, these questions, all these questions about remedy are essentially saying to you, rescind it yourself. We'll set it aside so everyone has fair game at it, notice and comment, stays subject to judicial review. But the worst case scenario for you is that the Fifth Circuit says, actually, the Department of Transportation cannot tell airlines that they have to tell their consumers what excessive fees there are, what surprise fees. So that's the worst case. So my question to you is, if we were to say that, would we be splitting with the D.C. Circuit in the Spirit case and essentially saying the rules they upheld, we, the Fifth Circuit, are saying they couldn't even promulgate?
Sure. I think that the court would be splitting probably both with the D.C. Circuit and the Seventh Circuit in the United Airlines case. The D.C. Circuit didn't specifically address a question of statutory authority, but in the course of its discussion, it said that the rule it was talking about was one that fell plainly within the statutory authority. I mean, I guess it would depend on exactly what the court said. You know, I don't want to say that whatever the court says, these rules would fall.
When you say they didn't discuss statutory authority, the first line of the decision is pursuant to its authority to regulate unfair and deceptive practices.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, all I meant was that there wasn't a statutory authority claim that was raised in that. That wasn't a separate claim that was raised.
Why don't you tell us the rule that you think's most important so that, I mean, federal judges, when we travel, the government 24, 365 days a year pays our fees if we change. So this is not a concern. I don't know these things, but I'm guessing working Americans are really worried about surprise fees at the last minute for a bag or when they change. So why don't you tell us the single most important rule that protects non-federal judges who don't worry about this stuff that would be lost if we said DOT can't even tell the airlines to do this?
Sure, I mean, I don't want to single out one.
No, I'd like to hear, hear one that's particularly protective of consumers today. It's price related.
Your Honor, I mean, I think a few that are important and that could potentially be called into question are ones like the 24-hour cancellation rule that I think everybody relies on when they book, you know, airfare. There's also rules about what happens if your plane is overbooked, if you need to switch flights. I mean, there's all kinds of things that, and these are rules that have been issued for generations under the same statutory authority, and Congress has never stepped in to say that it thinks that the agency is not supposed to be issuing these rules.
Which statutory authority? Are you talking about 417.12? Or is it the more general grant of rulemaking authority?
Your Honor, I think it's the combination of those two together. You know, I think.
Well, which one are you traveling under here?
Your Honor, I think it's both. I mean, I think what the agency is doing here is it's exercising its authority under 417.12.
Well, haven't some of those rules been promulgated after Congress passed specific provisions telling you to do it?
Your Honor, in some instances that happened, but in other instances it hasn't happened.
And in this case, Congress attempted, apparently, to legislate about this issue, and then nothing happened, right?
Your Honor, I don't think that's exactly right. I mean, part of what happened here was that there was a statute that was premised on some pieces of this rule and not other pieces.
Well, so Congress was moving in its own way. And another thing that I found significant, at least, was the amicus brief by the APTA crowd, which apparently provides all the airfare pricing information to us hoi polloi who search for fares on Kayak and Expedia and that kind of thing. And they said it was going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars to adapt to this rule, and the agency's finding blew it away. And B, they said that they have been working together with the airlines, they're a joint venture of thousands of airlines, to have more kinds of transparency. And again, the rule blew that away and didn't say let the industry operate under free competition and free markets.
So, I mean, I think all of those concerns that you have identified are ones that have to do with this rule in particular, which, again, the agency is saying is okay to set aside because of the notice and comment error, and that the agency itself has announced plans to rescind the proposed rescind.
So that all argues in favor, at least, of vacating the rule.
Your Honor, again, we agree that the court has the power under this particular statutory subsection to set aside the rule. If it, you know, again, I think the really important part that we are just emphasizing here is that we think it's important to look at kind of the fact-specific notice and comment violation.
Okay, are you saying we should just throw it out and move on? I mean, I thought that you liked the way the panel did this. Because you start all over if we vacate. Is that what you want to do, is start over? If so, why didn't you just tell us that and not have this en banc?
Your Honor, I think we did say that in our brief. I mean, that is what our brief, I understand, to say. And here...
At the panel level, but even now, I'm not understanding what... You wrote this thing about would examine... rescinding the ancillary fee disclosure and other miscellaneous requirements. Why don't you do you want us to just throw this out and move on?
Your Honor, my understanding is that, you know, I don't want to get ahead of the agency, but my understanding is that the agency's plan already, even before the court granted en banc, was early this year to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking that would rescind the challenge requirements. So I think we would end up in the same place.
Counsel, I'm wondering how much of a case of controversy we have, and so more of timing. Is this something this court can do if DOT is somehow, or DOJ advising them, believing they may be without authority, or otherwise? There's no need for us to go through all of this. If you're just waiting, DOT's just waiting to hear from us, go ahead.
Sure. I can't speak to what, you know, I think there have been other priorities in the change of the administration, but the agency has announced its plans early this year. I think the target date, at least originally, in the spring 2025 unified agenda, was to issue an NPRM in March 2026. I don't know if that date will hold. It may come later because the agency, you know, is handling a number of things.
They're handling things about crashes over Reagan Airport.
I mean,
that's one of their... something that's been high on the DOT radar, I believe. And those of us who travel to Washington, D.C. very much appreciate that.
Your Honor, I don't think that's implicated by, you know, what we're talking about here. And again, I mean, the agency, I think, is moving toward doing this anyway.
Why wouldn't we vacate the whole rule? Because it's intertwined and it's we can't pick and choose and say, we're going to leave these little aspects there. Because the arguments made by the lawyer for the smaller carriers, Frontier, et cetera, that the tremendous cost of the computer systems alone and the ability to talk to the third-party dealers in the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, it's all intertwined regardless of what rule you end up with or what numbers you get or what posting is required. Just the act of requiring a posting is what's costing this millions and millions of dollars and hasn't been considered. And so if you can't tinker with it to say, oh, well, this could be on the second page, really, because it's still requiring a big overhaul. And so that's why it's not appropriate and should be vacated in the entirety, not just some little quibble on the edge.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I don't think that we have suggested that it should just be on the edge. I mean, I think what our brief talked about was the challenge requirements, which would include, I think, what Your Honor is talking about, including, you know, the upfront disclosure.
But it's all intertwined. The whole thing, the posting the information in the manner prospectively to people in this way is intertwined with putting in the computer system, regardless of whether it's a specific thing here or you're a little bit moderate on this certain requirement being on this page or with a site link. It's still requiring a new computer system.
Sure, yeah, I mean, I don't think we're fighting that. And again, if the court thought that all of these provisions were intertwined, it would be, you know, permissible under the law to vacate the whole rule.
And then we would just vacate and be done with this case?
Your Honor, I think that is all that the court needs to do is to recognize...
If we did one sentence that just says, the rule is vacated, goodbye. Is that what you want us to say in an opinion? And then, but not remand it, not say anything about the future, and then y'all will just kind of start over because you, I guess, are in a different arena on what you think you should do?
Your Honor, I think that is the ultimate disposition we think is appropriate for the case. I mean, to the extent that the court is getting into the merits, we think all that the court needs to do is recognize our concession of error on the point that the merits panel found that there was a notice.
Yeah, but that is, to me, a different thing. Going back, the reason why we stayed the rule but remanded was so that you could have the discussion I mentioned with your colleagues over there about airlines and so on and so forth, and about consumers and this and that, and be in that cubby as opposed to starting all over again. But if you're wanting to start all over again, because y'all are in a different arena from the year that this was decided, then it seems to me that one sentence is all this court has to do.
Your Honor, I think the agency would be happy to start over again. The agency may have made itself, you know, now a different determination about whether or not this rule was necessary sort of from the beginning, and so I don't think that there's any reason or need to go beyond that.
But if you're agreeing to vacatur of the rule, which would be the ultimate relief we would be able to afford here, back to Judge Southwick's question, what is the case or controversy?
Sir, I think the idea that the rule is still on the books. I mean, of course, it's been stayed.
Well, yeah, I get all that. But I mean, the question in my mind is, why is it still on the books? If you agree to this, I'm not sure why we're here.
Sir, I mean, as I mentioned, the agency is moving toward issuing a notice of proposed rulemaking that would rescind these requirements. Of course, the court could wait for the agency to do that, and if the agency rescinds the rule itself, dismiss the case. But I think we would sort of end up in the same place if the court were to set aside the rule, you know, pursuant to the conceded notice and comment error that took place.
I mean,
in fairness,
there is a dispute between you and the airlines over the authority to issue the rule. That's sort of the precursor of saying it's arbitrary and capricious here, right? As 706 says, arbitrary, capricious, or contrary to law. So you're saying DOT... I mean, I'd prefer it were otherwise, but DOT takes issue with the airlines on the scope of its rulemaking authority, right?
So, Your Honor, I mean, there's still a legal dispute about the agency's statutory authority here, but I think with respect to this rule, the agency has conceded that there was a notice and comment error that warrants relief against this rule.
I agree with Judge Jones. Isn't that why? That's the legal proposition I thought you were here defending, which is that the Supreme Court has never held that a rule can't stand on general rulemaking authority combined with specific authority to root out unfair practices. I thought that's the law you're just trying to make sure we don't disagree with.
You're on, right? I mean, I completely agree with that. I think it is entirely right that this administration, like prior administrations, recognizes that the agency has authority here pursuant to 401.
And if it didn't have the authority, let's say it goes back down. Let's say you don't rescind it. We go back down. Everyone gets their fair shot at it. Then it still comes back up for arbitrary and capricious. But also, even after that, under the Congressional Review Act, if Congress thinks the agency overstepped, it kills it that way too, right?
Your Honor, right. I think there are many other mechanisms by which these rules can be reviewed. And I mean, one other point I would make as well is that the petitioners here didn't even raise the statutory authority argument in the rulemaking. In the future, if there are future rulemakings,
opposing counsel, I thought, said they did.
Your Honor, my understanding is that they did not raise those points in the rulemaking. And to the extent that they do, the agency in the future can try to address those points in the issuance of the rule.
May I probe this theory of yours that this would upend unfair and deceptive trade practices throughout the government? Number one, this statement about unfair and deceptive, or just the phrase, was modeled on the FTC, correct?
And that's correct, Your Honor. They use different, you know, the same definitions across.
Right, and it's a little bit different. This 47.112, whatever it is, it's a little bit different, though, because it says the agency may investigate, find that it is unfair and deceptive, and stop the practice. Now, in the FTC Act, am I correct? There are two separate statutory provisions, and one of them says you can adjudicate unfair and deceptive, and another provision says you can make rules about unfair and deceptive. Is that right?
Your Honor, I'm not totally familiar with the differences between the authority here and the authority that the FTC has. I mean, I think to address the point here, what the statute says is that the agency may investigate and decide that, you know, airlines are engaged in unfair and
deceptive practices. It said an airline is engaged and rule with respect to an airline. Now, there is certainly the possibility, I suppose, of a mass action. We're going to bring three or four airlines in, and then we're going to adjudicate. But the agency did not adjudicate anything here, did it?
Your Honor, I think the agency did adjudicate. It did have...
It notice and comment rulemaking is far cry from adjudication, which is why they're completely different things in the APA.
Sorry, I didn't mean to suggest. I think it's important to. As a formal matter, it didn't do an adjudication here. It did a notice and comment proceeding. It also held a hearing, but it is allowed to do that pursuant to its authority under 40113A, which says that the agency specifically is allowed to prescribe regulations. And Supreme Court cases that stretch back, you know, many, many decades, including the American Hospital Association case that I don't think the other side responds to, says that that sort of grant of authority from Congress is a general grant of rulemaking.
Well, maybe I'm just completely wrong, but I think, are there any other statutes about adjudication that say the agency may investigate, find its own, and stop? Is the word stop in any of these other adjudicatory things?
Your Honor, I don't know if it's in any others. I don't have any off the top of my head. Of course, the Seventh Circuit in the United Airlines case addressed this exact statutory authority.
Well, the Seventh Circuit, I know, and in several respects, Judge Posner used methods of interpretation that have since been disavowed in the Supreme Court. So, you know, I'm not denying there were rulemakings in the past, and I'm intrigued about the limits that the airlines are suggesting exist here. But to the extent you say that if we took this provision and said that it prescribes adjudication as a powerful method of determining what's unfair and deceptive, and maybe some rulemaking behind that, it's not going to affect everything.
You know, I guess it depends what the court says. I mean, again, we would ask the court to, you know, follow the principle to the extent that the court is addressing this, which, again, we don't think the court needs to get into, but we would ask the court to follow the principle that the Supreme Court has enunciated over and over, that even if a statute talks about specifically adjudications and provides that as one way to enforce a statutory mandate, the agency is still permitted to engage in rulemaking. And the point of doing the rulemaking is to give the regulated industry notice about what here the agency has determined is an unfair or deceptive practice.
Counsel, won't you respond? It's hard to get a question in, and that's why you get interrupted sometimes. I'm sorry. Respond to the arguments on the other side, though, that would seem to have, you know, some reasonableness to it. What 41712 talks about are specific unfair labor practices, not what good conduct, not what good practices are. So this figure, that the rulemaking general authority that you have that would draw from the adjudication provision is to label something an unfair practice.
Your Honor,
but instead, you said forevermore, this is the only way to do what is necessary. So why doesn't that matter in your view?
Sure, I mean, a couple things here. I mean, I think the agency did, that is, what you've described is what the agency did here. What it said is, we've identified, in particular, the unfair practice of failing to disclose upfront baggage change and cancellation fees.
So the unfair practice is not to have everything on your first screen. I mean, is that the definition? So therefore, having everything on first screen is a way to resolve or ameliorate that problem?
Your Honor, I mean, I think it's not strange for the agency to say we're, you know, saying that this is the unfair practice and sort of the result of that, and the way to operationalize it is you can kind of only do it in one particular way. Although here, I would note that this left, the rule leaves the airlines with multiple options for how to display this information.
Doesn't really?
It provides a very specific guidance of how to display the information. And, you know, this is an issue in like the Airbnb and Booking.com hotels and things. And some of the companies advertise that the price quoted on the front screen includes the fees and all of that. And so you have that on the front screen. And some of the companies wait till the second screen that you want to pay, and it has it, but it always has it, what the total amount is, but the amount on the front screen is not always the total amount, and some companies try to say there are better companies because they put it on the front screen. All that being said, the companies that put it on the second screen or before, as long as you do it before total, that doesn't make it unfair or bad, as long as they're telling you before you hit the thing. It's just, there's a preference to putting it on the front screen, and people might have competitive advantages by choosing to put it on the front screen, and the industry's not able to, this industry would not be able to test that. But if the government tells them exactly cookie cutter screens, and by golly, you all better set these up, and only the really big airlines can afford to set those up because it's such a huge outlay of capital for computer systems.
Sure. I think these points are really best addressed at an arbitrary and capricious question. And I can tell you that what the department determined here is it said failing to disclose these things up front was unfair and deceptive. That was the determination it made. But in the process, it left the airlines with the ability to display the information in different ways. They could use pop-ups. They could use expandable text. They could do other things as long as it didn't navigate the passenger away from the page. The passenger is also allowed to affirmatively indicate I don't need information about baggage, and then they don't have to show it on their online website. So I think that this does, it targets what the department determined was an unfair or deceptive practice, and then left, you know, the remainder up to the airlines to try to devise innovative ways to show this information in a way that passengers can find.
Mr.
But with that regard to cost, and that's the arbitrary piece, right?
Sure, right. And to the extent we're talking about costs or the weighing of different considerations here, that would be about arbitrary and capricious. And again, I would just go back to the idea that, you know, here it is the government's position that there was a notice and comment error, and I think that's all the court needs to say about the APA.
Mr. Springer, hi. You know what I think, because I wrote the stay panel opinion. So I hear your argument that you are acting under a combination of regulatory authority, 41712A plus 40113. Am I hearing that right? You have a combination of regulatory authority.
I think it's possible that this could be sustained just under 41712, but the court doesn't have to get that far because you've got both.
Well, I just asked, are you saying you are acting under the combination of those two sections for your regulatory authority to promulgate the rule?
Sure, I think the agency said it could be either, but I think it's best thought of as being both.
I've heard you say you're acting under both. In your view, see, my problem that I wrote about in the state panel opinion was that one serious problem was that this code of regulations or code of prescriptions or whatever you call it for what the airlines are supposed to do goes so far beyond stop the practice or method. Stop the practice or method. That's what 41712 says in black and white. Stop the practice or method. Is the government's argument that actually its regulations do not have to stop the practice or method, but can go beyond that and require all sorts of affirmative actions? I just want to know the government's argument. Maybe we never have to reach it because maybe this is all going to go away, but what is the government's answer to that?
A couple of points in response to that. I think, first of all, we do think that there's a separate authority in the first sentence that talks about investigating and deciding whether or not, you know, airlines have been engaged in this practice. But here, I do think that what the department determined was...
You don't think the stop the practice or method is connected to the first sentence?
Your Honor, we think they work together in tandem. And what I think
otherwise,
what the department
be
did here... Okay. Sorry, Your Honor.
I didn't understand that. You think that there's a separate power to investigate and decide that allows the government to sort of prescribe this code beyond the stop the practice or method?
Your Honor, Your Honor, I mean, we do think that those, you know, both of those are sort of potentially different grants of authority. Again, and even if you just focus on the
do
stop.
Do you think they are, or do you think they're not? Just what, can you just tell me the government?
We do think they are, but we don't think the court needs to reach that, because here the practice that the department defined was the practice of failing to disclose upfront baggage claim and cancellation fees.
Okay, can
and
a regulation go beyond saying stop that?
You know, I mean,
prescribe all these other things.
I guess I don't really see it as prescribing anything. I mean, I think the department has the authority to prescribe, as the Supreme Court has said, analyzing similar language in 40113. But here, what the...
So can 40113 expand the regulatory authority that is given by 41712?
Your Honor, I don't think it's expanding. I think here what the agency is doing is it's acting within, you know, the textual limits of its statute, of the statutes. I mean,
well, but you've got a statute that gives a grant of general authority. That's what it says in 40113, right? And then you've got a whole series of statutes, some of which say you can make rules to effectuate it. This one doesn't say that. It says you can investigate and decide, and then you can stop the practice. I mean, it sort of suggests the general would be superseded by the specific, would it not?
Sure. I think an important point to this that I think helps...
Would the specific not supersede the general?
Your Honor, there is a doctrine that says, you know, the specific can overcome the general, but here I think they're connected, and I think a place to see that is in the penalty provision. If you look at the penalty provision...
Well, I get the penalty provision lists this section, 41712, but, I mean, you heard counsel opposite say, yeah, there may be some rulemaking authority in this section, but it's to set the stage for investigating and deciding what may or may not be a deceptive practice. That's a far cry from prescribing a bunch of things that you say, here's what you have to do.
You know, I mean, again, I would focus the court on what the rule actually says, which is, you know, the practice that we're talking about is failing to disclose upfront these fees.
I get it. And you can say, back to Judge Duncan's question, you can say that is a deceptive practice. Period.
And that's
stop
what the,
it.
I think that's
period.
What the agency has done.
It goes way more than that, does it not?
You know what I mean? I think that is what the agency has done, is it has said you can't fail to disclose upfront these fees, and if you do, that is an unfair deceptive practice.
Can you just take a second to explain that? Because I think I understand your argument. It's that you are complying with the terms of 401712, and I think your theory is, by waiting till page 2, that is deceptive. Can you just take a moment to explain why do you think that's deceptive? Why does the government think that's deceptive? Is it because people have already kind of bought in once they've gone through page 2 or page 3, they're kind of locked in, they don't, is that the idea of deception?
So, you know, what the department determined, at least at the time, you know, is an explanation of the rule, is what it said was, the problem is you kind of can't, when you're buying airfare, right, part of the problem
bait
is
switch
you go through too many pages, you're then going to get stuck with this. It's also the fact that because of the fact that you have to sort of follow a bunch of different links to figure out what the price actually is, you're not going to be able to compare prices across airlines. It's very difficult to understand what the cost is.
I've had some of the same difficulty, I think, questions are asking. What is the government's position? Are you relying solely under what I call 712? Or do the two complement each other so that DOT, when it sees specific deceptive, they say stop, then they see a lot of those. So instead of just always whack-a-mole, they decide to issue one rule that says, all of you, upfront and obvious, your extra fee.
Your Honor, I think that's the right way to think about what's going on here, and that's the way the Supreme Court has described similar authority. And what it is, look, we can go out and one by one tell people, you know, you can't do this, you can't do this. But once we see that there is a problem, we can tell people we think that engaging in this practice is unfair and deceptive. To give, and again, I mean, part of the point of this is to give the regulated community notice about what the agency thinks
is unfair
and deceptive.
But isn't that the point of airline deregulation, that the DOT has limited this is not the NLRB, which regulates labor management relations in every workplace more than X number of people. This is the Airline Deregulation Act that has a particularly narrow adjudicative function for unfair and deceptive. Not that it doesn't exist, not that some things are not systemic, like staying on the tarmac for 3 hours and so on, but that it says stop, which is narrow.
Your Honor, the department and its predecessor agencies have had this statutory authority since 1938.
Not in that term, though.
It has always been in that term.
Not in terms of stop.
Your Honor, I think it has either said cease and desist or stop. And this is the authority that the agency has relied on to issue the numerous familiar rules that we discussed in our brief.
Thank you.
Seeing no hands or hearing no one, thank you. You, Mr. Devoretsky, is that right, Devoretsky?
Yes, thank you. The court should vacate the rule, and it should do so on statutory authority grounds. I understand that the government at this point would like for this rule to go away. If it had wanted to rescind the rule, it's had a year to do so. It would have to go through notice and comment. It would have to justify the rescission. That rescission could itself, of course, be challenged. By those who might favor the rule. And we don't actually know what the government thinks the limits of its statutory authority are. The government in the NPRM says one thing. I quoted it earlier. The government in its brief says another. And the government here today can't seem to commit to basic propositions about what the source and limits of authority are. So we don't know what the government's going to do next after sitting on this rule for the last year. What we do know is that obviously we're all here convened today. There is an actual case or controversy over the validity of this rule. There is a statutory review provision.
But he just said we can vacate the whole thing, the whole rule. So why wouldn't we just do that and move on?
Because as a matter of judicial process and also as a matter of not encouraging gamesmanship by government agencies, it makes little sense to vacate the rule on the question of whether the government dotted its I's and crossed its T's and what it did, without first asking whether the government had the authority to do what it did in the first place. It's far too convenient.
Do you think it had rulemaking authority under the prior iterations of the statute to address unfair deceptive practices?
I think it had under both the prior and the current versions of the statute some rulemaking authority to address unfair deceptive practices.
And tell me, I'm just having difficulty seeing where you draw the line based on the statute, the lines you're trying to draw. I just want to see the statutory language that draws those lines.
Sure. So, and I think it's helpful to contrast it with the Civil Aeronautics Board statute. That statute said that the Civil Aeronautics Board shall prescribe the lawful practice after finding an unlawful. This statute doesn't say that. It says DOT has the authority to investigate and decide whether an air carrier has been engaged in an unfair deceptive practice and to stop the practice. That, according to DOT's own October 2025 NPRM, represents the limits of the department's statutory authority. So,
this is a word game, frankly. The unfair practice is failing to put it all on one page so the consumer doesn't have to search different websites, different pages. So they tell the airlines, stop doing that. Put it on one page. Stop the unfair practice of navigating away from the first page. Now, how is that different? I just don't see the difference.
Because 41712 contemplates an adjudicatory process where DOT reviews an airline's practice. They have not reviewed a single airline's practice of not putting the information on the first page. All of the airlines, again, that I represent, put the information on the first page. So they have not followed Section 41712 and identified an airline's practice that they believe is unlawful. What they have done instead is come up out of whole cloth with a scheme that they want enforced. That is what the Civil Aeronautics Board could perhaps do, prescribing the lawful practice. That is not stopping a particular unlawful practice. So in terms of what this court should hold, it should hold as a matter of statutory authority that DOT lacked the power to promulgate this rule. 41712 doesn't confer prescriptive authority. It only confers the authority to stop an unfair deceptive practice. And in terms of what makes a rule prescriptive, it is the difference between, on the one hand, adjudicating whether an air carrier has been engaged in an unfair deceptive practice, which is okay,
And on the other hand, requiring airlines to use a particular alternative practice from among possible alternatives the DOT hasn't adjudicated. That is what's happening here. And again, we're...
You've answered my question.
Just a quick question. If we were to vacate, as you want and as government seems to concede, but on different grounds, if we were to vacate solely on the procedural grounds, I know that's not what you want, but if we were to do that, would that preclude a future court from addressing the statutory arguments you're making today? I assume it wouldn't.
No, I don't think it
I know you want it today, but we could do it later, in theory.
I certainly hope so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 2 points on rebuttal. The question was asked about, you know, is the government's line basically that going to pay, putting the baggage fees on page two, is that where they draw the line on some fairness? And I think it emphasizes the irrationality of the rule, both the First Amendment and the APA, that if page one is the fair, then airlines already show the every single fee that you would have to pay to fund that airline on page zero before you get to the fair. You go on the front page of the website and you can see every single ancillary fee, baggage fee, by route, by date, right there. And if the point was to have it on the first page, then why not have it apply to MetaSearch platform, Google Flights, Kayak, TripAdvisor, all the websites that for many consumers is their first point of entry to compare fares across every airline that's traveling to a certain destination on a certain day, they don't require that.
My understanding is that the rule would require that for the Kayak and Expedia. I mean, reading that amicus brief.
The rule would require for the airlines...
Not for Google and Meta, but for Kayak and Expedia.
Well, Kayak and Google sort of do the same thing. So they aggregate all the airline prices, so it wouldn't do it for them. And I think my last point to end is the government's position here, taken to its full limit, is that under the Unfair and Deceptive Practices Authority, they can regulate price. If they think it's unfair and deceptive, they can say, you are not allowed to charge for this.
Thank you. We have your argument. The court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you.